chapter 9, verse 1. So God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth, and the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth." Now you think that went through you, well, what happened? Now before the flood, in fact, in the Garden of Eden, did Adam name all of the animals? And it's not just giraffe and hippopotamus. I bet he named them Lenny and Fluffy and Fufu, and I think it could have been that. In other words, the animals and the humans had a much closer relationship. We're going to see here after the flood that now we see that the diet of people are going to start being more meat. Fascinating. So I wonder if the fear of every beast on earth has to do with now because the humans are hunting them on every bird of the air and on all that move on the earth and on all of the fish of the sea. For they are given into your hand, inferred, to eat now. So I wonder if that's now going to put a big sort of kink in the relationship of humans and animals. Verse 3. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as green herbs. Now what we have here is what's called the Noah covenant or the Noahic covenant. And because if you're like me, what? We'll show everybody what this is already. Let's go to these covenants. There are eight, by the way. We're going to encounter the Noah covenant today. So if you look up there, this is helpful. Here was the very first one. The Eden covenant or the Edenic covenant. And that was Genesis 2. What's covenant? It's contract. God says, I will do ABC. You humans will do ABC, whatever it is, so we agree. And then if you renege on yours, I will renege on mine. And we're going to see some of these covenants or contracts are one way. Some of them are two-party contracts. The first one was the Eden contract. And Eden, we saw that in Genesis 2. God said to Adam, all right, enjoy this Garden of Eden. Eat all these wonderful fruits and enjoy all of these amazing animals. What a great place that was. Now, if this contract becomes in default, when what? When they eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What was the result of breaking that contract? You're going to have to leave, Adam. And there was a separation not only between Adam and Adam and God, Eve and God, but you see there you have the first marital spat that happens in Genesis 3. Adam, who told you you were naked? Did you eat of the fruit of the tree I told you not to? What does Adam do? It was the woman did it. The woman. And then they used to be naked and felt no shame, total connection. Now there's a rift. So a lot of things change. So because they broke, the humans did, that covenant or contract, you got to get out. Because God says, I can't have you eating the tree of life and living forever in an ever deteriorating fashion. Number two, go. The Adam covenant, or the Adamic covenant, we saw that in Genesis 3. God said to Adam, get a job. Now, see, before they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and now for the first time can conceptualize evil, all you think about is good things. And God says, what are you going to do all day? How about hang out with me, your beautiful wife and husband? All of these amazing animals and all of this glorious sunshine and perfection and harmony and bliss and light and love and family. Isn't that awesome? Well, then when you eat of that tree of the knowledge of good and evil, now you have the ability to conceptualize, and now the adage kicks in. Idle hands are the devil's workshop. There's really something to, in our fallen nature, stay busy. Stay busy. Do something. If unemployment is your current situation or retirement or whatever it might be, then ask God to show you what it is you can do. Because sitting at home swiping right is going to grind on you. And that's when the enemy goes, how about this? And let's do a little bit of that over there. And that's when you get into trouble. To Eve, he said, birthing children is going to cause great pain. Now, is that anatomically? Could be. Or moms, dads too, you love your kids like crazy, but do they ever bring a great challenge to your life? And do sometimes what happens to them, could it break your heart? Let's go to Mary, who loved her son Jesus, and watch them whip him and beat him and stab him in the side with a spear and crucify him. Would that have brought a significant amount of pain to a mom? Could be that. When is the Adamic covenant, when does it enter default? That's when Adam is not being a biblical husband, or Eve is not being a biblical wife. In other words, both are abdicating important responsibilities. Now, when that happens, the system begins to break down. The result? Family and society goes off the rails. Well, what happens? It goes off the rails enough that we saw a couple weeks ago that the thoughts and intent of a man's heart were evil continually. And that's going to lead, of course, to the flood. Now, go ahead, number three. We're looking here in Genesis 9, the Noah covenant. Now, when he gets done here, here's what's going to happen. God promises, now here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to flood the whole earth again with rain. I'm not going to flood the whole earth again with water. In fact, every time it rains, because remember, Adam, Noah, and family, they never saw a rainbow because it never rained like we're used to. Now it's raining. Could you imagine they'd get a little twitchy if it started to rain? You going to do that flood thing again? And God says, nope, I'm going to put that rainbow in the sky, and that's going to be a reminder of my grace for you. Also, what the Noah covenant does, it authorizes human government, and an important part of human government, as God has designed, you have to have capital punishment. We'll see here in a minute. If somebody kills a person in a premeditated fashion, spills their blood, then that person's blood is required. Sounds a little kind of rough in some of our sort of Western sort of modalities, but God says you've got to take someone who has decided to take another life. You have to take theirs. Why? Because if you don't, that chaos will spread. Well, when is the Noah covenant in default? It's when the leaders of these governments exploit the weak, and eventually are going to ruin the earth that God gave to them to give them life. What's the result? The result is World War III. That's coming one of these days, or the Book of Revelation. Much of the terrible things that are mentioned in the Book of Revelation is not God doing it. It's God taking his favor and protection away, and the humans are doing much of the destruction to themselves. So that's what's going to happen. And if Jesus said, if I didn't come back and stop that, World War III in the Valley of Armageddon, that it will culminate, there would be no flesh left on the earth. Number four, the Abrahamic covenant we'll get to in Genesis 12. This is a very important covenant. This is the covenant that says, Abraham, this is your promised land. I give it to you and to Isaac and to Jacob and the 12 tribes of Israel. Remember, Abraham has another son, not by Sarah, but by his own sort of devices. Well, that's Ishmael. Ishmael has 12 sons too that become 12 tribes. But this land is not for them. It is for the Jewish people, the descendants of Abraham. So that the land belongs to Abraham, and the rightful son, Isaac. And also the Abrahamic covenant is, Messiah is going to come from the Jewish people, and all nations will be blessed through Abraham's seed, singular. What's the default? The answer is never, because the Abrahamic covenant is a one-party contract. Mosaic covenant, we're going to look at here in a minute, is two-party. God says, if you, well, then I will. The Abrahamic covenant is one party. If you remember what happens, they split these animals, the idea of cutting a covenant, and then the two parties are supposed to meet in the middle. But Abraham prepares the animals and have, and he's waiting. He gets heavy eyelids, and then he goes to sleep. And then he sees the Lord in a dream coming up like a big furnace and meets Abraham on his side. That's all very picturesque language for God's own covenant. And what does Abraham have to do or not do? Nothing. This is very important. The Mosaic covenant, we're going to see in a minute, is two-party. If you do yours, then I'll do mine. When they come into the promised land under Moses, that's the Mosaic covenant. Well, what happens if they don't? They get kicked out of the land a couple different times. But when they got into the land in 1948, it was not under the Mosaic covenant. There were no Levitical priests. There was no temple or tabernacle. They came into the land in 1948 under the Abraham, one party. Under the Mosaic, if they messed up, they got chunked out of the land. Since 1948, you can say with all confidence, Israel will never be uprooted again because of the Abrahamic covenant. Doesn't matter what you do, Israel, I'm going to be faithful. Hit our go button. Let's go to covenant number 5. That's the Mosaic covenant that we just got done talking about. There's your law, your 613 do's and don'ts. Well, how do you default on that? You transgress the law. And that usually leads to idolatry, self-centeredness, and of course, every evil from there. Well, what's the result? God removes Israel from that promised land, but just for a season. And now we're going to get to number 6, go. It's often referred to as the Palestinian covenant. You need to know that God calls his land his land. When the Jews got kicked out in 70 AD, there was a couple more skirmishes, the sum of which is you get roughly around 120, 130 AD. And the emperor in Rome says, I'm sick and tired of all these insurrections. I want you to go to Israel and kill every last Jew. And those that escape, make it a law, you cannot come. They salt all of the area of the temple so that nothing will grow. And then they build a Roman temple to Jupiter. And they change the name from Israel to Palestinia. Why? Because they named it after their hated rivals, the Philistines. So it was a concerted effort of the Roman Empire, specifically the emperor, to rename the whole place. Change the name. Don't call it Jerusalem anymore. Call it Aeolia Capitolina. In other words, we want every vestige of potential Jewish connection to be eradicated. So I personally am a little uneasy with the idea of Palestinia, because that's named after the Philistines. And today, are there people completely misunderstanding that there was never ever a land, a nation, a homogeneous people or culture of Palestine? Never has been. Never has been a symphony. There's never been a national anthem. There's never been a currency. There's never been any semblance of a government of a Palestinian nation. Never. But if you don't know your history, you would listen to everybody on the liberal media saying, well, those poor Palestinians got booted out of their land. They never had a nation. But anyway, Palestinian covenant is this. It's out of Deuteronomy 30, and this is God's contract promise. I will always regather my people when they got chunked out of the land for disobedience and idolatry. Well, this would never be defaulted on. Nope, because it's a one-party contract. The result was, well, the first time, 538 BC, did God bring the captives and the exiles from Babylon? He sure did. Then there's a second one, 1948. That's when they returned Israel to the land after 19 centuries. And this, as I said earlier, that's the Abrahamic covenant. There's going to be a final regathering. Did you know that currently the nation of Israel, Jerusalem is their capital, they're going to embrace the secular, are going to embrace the Antichrist as their Messiah. So for the first 3.5 years of that 7-year Great Tribulation, the Antichrist kind of takes a look out after them, and they think the Antichrist is their Messiah. Well, halfway in between, everything changes. And then God takes the blindness in part that went on when they rejected Jesus on Palm Sunday. Comes off, ding, and they go, whoa, whoa, you're so not our Messiah. And then as a nation, they cry out for Jesus. What do you think the Antichrist thinks of that? He goes after them wholesale. And he chases Jews all over the planet. And then the Bible says something quite disturbing. That the Antichrist will be successful in the second half of the Great Tribulation. He will be successful in killing 2 out of every 3 Jewish person. As awful as it may sound initially, the Holocaust was allowed by the Lord. You got to get into Deuteronomy 28, right around verse 64, that God knew the Holocaust was coming. And as terrible as it was still just a dress rehearsal for when the Antichrist, Hitler, was a model and a dress rehearsal for what the Antichrist will do. And if the Jewish person is not in the rock city of Petra, which will be supernaturally protected, the Antichrist is going to get them. So they're going to scatter them all. So the final embodiment of this Palestinian covenant, final time, is at the beginning of the millennial reign. Antichrist is dealt with. Jesus is living on the planet. And then he says, come on back, everybody. And all the Jews who survived, they return. And then Jesus says, let's begin the 1,000-year reign of Messiah. So that's the last time. Next, go ahead, is number 7. That's the David covenant. Davidic covenant. That's 2 Samuel 7. And that's a promise by God saying that the king of everything and forever, humans, is going to come from King David. He will be descended from this particular person. Is there a default? Nope, never. God's going to accomplish this. The result? Jesus will return to the earth. He's coming back. And when he does, he will rule and reign for all eternity. And then finally, number 8, remember numbers in the Bible are significant. 8 is the number of new beginnings. 7 is the number of completion. So there's a number 8 covenant, and this makes sense. It's a brand new beginning. Well, what's it called? It's the new covenant. We've seen a lot about it. It's Jeremiah 31, verses 33 and 34, also Hebrews 8. This is when God will remember Israel's sin no more. And God will write truth on every human heart. Jesus told us about that. That's when the Holy Spirit is poured out in the 2nd chapter of the book of Acts. And that's when God brings his beautiful conviction of sin. Man, I know what I shouldn't be doing. Of righteousness, I know what I should be doing. And that there's a judgment day. Is it ever in default? It's in default if Israel, and really any human, refuses the Holy Spirit's conviction. And therefore, you don't believe that Jesus is who he said he is. He's not my Messiah. I don't know who he is, but he's not whatever. And therefore, you have rejected his free gift of salvation. What's the result of breaking that contract? Eternal separation from God. And his light and love and family and purpose. All right, so there you have them. There's your 1 through 8. Now we go to verse 4. Let's zero in on this Noah covenant. Verse 4. But you shall not eat flesh with its life. That is the blood. Now you can eat meat, but you have to drain it of its blood. Really? This is what the Bible calls a first mention of life is in the blood. Now, the doctor would tell you, well, of course it is. Blood carries oxygen and food and carries away waste. Well, it really is life. Someone loses enough blood, they will lose their life. But think deeper. Can you think of any innocent blood, life, that was shed? Yes, it's Jesus. This is a huge theology all through the Old Testament. Don't drink blood. Don't eat blood. Drain it, because the life is in the blood. And if you eat things with blood in it, and you know better, God says that's a very bad thing to do, because it is a model. The life is in the blood. Verse 5. Surely for your lifehood I will demand a reckoning from the hand of every beast. I will require it, and from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of a man. What's he talking about? Verse 6. Whoever sheds men's blood by man, that guy's blood will be shed. For in the image of God, he, the Lord, made man. This is God saying you have to have a functioning and equitable and judicious law system that if someone premeditates somebody else's death, you have to put them to death. You have to do it. God says you take away that, you are literally taking away at its very basis an ability for a governmental system to work. Now, as you know, that's really not popular thought these days, but this is what God says. Have you noticed that the devil is desperate to kill humans? And he hates you so much, you know, bang, he shoots you and you fall over. That's not what he wants. He wants the most hateful, violent death possible. Why? Because he hates humans. Why does he hate humans so much? What does God love more than anything else in his creation? Than us. I don't know that I have found it. You need to know something, that he sees us as his sons and daughters. He loves everything that he made, and he has a great affinity for all of that, animals and what have you, a great compassion. But there is something very, very deep about the devotional love of God for you and me. It's one of the reasons why the devil hates you so much, because God loves you so much. People have hope. People have an intense love and affection, have the intense love and affection of God. Maybe that's why Satan hates humans so much. And also because of all the creation, we humans bear the strongest likeness to God. And does Satan hate God? He surely does. Here God is saying that the very basis of effective government has to be that everybody must recognize the value of every human life. Suicide should be against the law. And in most places it is. And have you noticed that the laws are slackening? What about people who are so very, very, very sick? And that does happen. But by and large, those are such a small minority. If the laws were to open up that you could have a medically assisted suicide, probably a 90-some plus, 95, 96% of the assisted suicide would be by people not in some egregious, terrible end stage of life disease. It would be people who are bumming about this or that. It's one of the reasons why it's against the law. But if you notice, they're starting to slack up on that. Isn't it funny, especially America, save the spotted owls and save the whales, but kill the babies in the womb? And let a convicted murderer serve 15, 16 years and get out? Do you see along with me that there's something wrong with that? Especially what we're looking at now. A society that devalues human life. So you killed someone. I'm not talking about manslaughter. I'm not talking about accidental death. I'm talking about someone who knew what they were doing and bypassed God's every spiritual unction to not go there and carried out a murder. You devalue human life. Does God value human life? Yes. In a society that devalues human life, of course you can kill them in the womb. It's devaluing God's design for a successful society. And by the way, what happens to every society and culture that does what is right in their own eyes? What happens? They blow up. Good place here to write Proverbs 14, verse 12. I'll read it to you. There is a way that feels right to a man, but the end thereof is death and destruction. Moving on, verse 7. Yeah, one more thought. How many of you have a sense that the current judicial system here in America has some problems? Somebody breaks into your house and you have certain restrictions on what you can and what you cannot do to defend yourself or your family. It's getting weird. It is getting weird when someone does whatever crime of an industrial banking fraud thing, they get X amount of years, but somebody who killed another person gets less time. Do you see what's happening at the core? This society has devalued human life. God does not devalue human life. Please be in prayer and intercede for this nation. Verse 7. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply, Noah, Mrs. Noah, and all the boys and their wives. Bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it. Verse 8. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, as for me, behold, I will establish my covenant, there you go, the Noahic covenant, with you and with your descendants after you. Verse 10. And with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you, Noah covenant. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of a flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy all the earth. Well, how do we know you're serious about it, Lord? Verse 12. So God said, and this will be a sign of this covenant. What's the covenant? I promise not to destroy all the world with a universal flood again. Because remember, now it's raining. And every time it started raining, did the animals twitch or did Noah twitch? You're going to do it again? Don't worry about it, because here's what I'm going to do. And this is the sign of my covenant, Noah covenant, which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generation. What is it, Lord? Verse 13, I am going to give you a rainbow. Oh, isn't that sweet? Because what is a rainbow? It's falling water, and if the sun is in a certain position, what happens is those little spheres of water following act like a prism, and they separate the colors of the rainbow. And so there was never rained before the flood, so there was no rainbow. So now when it rains, do you see a rainbow now and again? Isn't that cool? But it's also God saying, this is a sign that I promise I will not judge the earth because of. It's a kind of a sin. Let me show what I'm talking about. Verse 13, one more time. I'm going to put a rainbow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of covenant between me and the earth. Now, what was the rainbow a reminder of? That God's grace will not judge the whole earth. Let's revisit why he had to judge. Flip a few pages to the left. Go to chapter 6. Just to kind of refresh our memory. Genesis chapter 6, go there. Look at verse number 1. Genesis 6, verse 1. How did this whole flood thing get started? Here's why. chapter 6, verse 1. Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God, we saw that, those are angels, really fallen angels, saw that the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives from themselves of whom they chose. Well, what'd they do? Interest of time, verse 4. And there were giants or Nephilim, meaning the fallen ones, on the earth. Well, how'd they get there? Because the angels were somehow manifesting some physiology and they were having sexual intercourse with the humans, if you will. Is that bad? Yeah, because freaky giants were being born to them and the giants were causing terrible havoc. And so also Satan is trying to go after the bloodline, the genealogy. Because in the garden, after they had eaten, God says to Eve, your seed is going to crush his head. So Lucifer was paying attention. Somehow these beings manifested. Oh, parenthetically, don't be surprised if in the near future they're going to produce bodies of aliens. What? We've got a teaching on that, UFOs and probable prophecy. But I want you to notice these aliens have a biology, say some, in some of these crashes of these UFOs with bizarre metals that are not on our periodic chart. Who are they? I believe that is part of the great deception that is going to come. Don't be freaked out and they parade in frozen in whatever. There is a alien being. What? Who are they? The distances between planets and stars are so ginormous, they're not intergalactic travelers. And since the 70s, the greatest ufologists are saying, yeah, transgalactic travel is impossible, but interdimensional. Now we're talking. And that's the popular thesis now. They can't go from planet to planet because the distances are enormous. But everybody's on board now. We're okay with dimensions. Einstein told us about dimensions. So they're interdimensional beings. And we go, yeah, we know who they are. And if somebody brings or shows on television, here is an alien body, please see and remember Genesis 6. Were the demons some way, shape, or form somehow working within the four-dimensional system that we're used to and were physiological, biological bodies a result? Yes. They've done it before. Oh, by the way, Jesus said, as it was in the days of what? Noah. So it shall be right before I come back. So I want you to see here. Demons, who are interdimensional creatures, are somehow manifesting a physiology, and they're actually transmitting genetic material, and freaky giants are the result. Verse 4. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God, fallen demons, came to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men, that's not a good thing, who were of old, the men of renown. Now right here, this is one of the reasons why God had to scrub the surface of the earth. The enemy is trying to mess with the genetics. Later on, we saw that Noah was perfect in his generations, in his genome. Let me rephrase. Did God flood the planet because of sin? Yes. But more specifically, what kind of sin? Perverse sexuality that was a progenitor of freaky, freaky beings. I want to keep that in mind. And what is the sign that God promises humans that I won't flood the earth because of that horrific sexual sin, which was a part of it? A rainbow. Everybody got it? A huge portion of what was on men and women's heart continually was perverse sexual sin. Is everybody seeing where I'm getting that? You may or may not agree, but The reason he flooded the earth was for those reasons. It's fascinating to me that the flag of the LGBTQ community is a what? Hit our go button, Chris, if you would. It's a rainbow. Now, they're beautiful colors, and to that community, all colors and ethnicities are welcome. That's what they're saying. But especially in light of Genesis chapter 9, I'm going to put a rainbow in the sky to say that I'm not going to judge the whole planet because of mostly perverse sexual sin. Fascinating that this particular movement that is gaining political power is what? The rainbow? Is that an accident? I don't think so. I don't think they're deliberately doing it like that. They don't know it, but I believe they're prompted by mocking demons to wave God's own rainbow back in his face. Ha! What are you going to do about it, God? The demons know about the rainbow. The demons know that God's promise of grace, and the enemy is trying to poke at God. What you going to do about it, God? Can't do it. Got a rainbow. If you will permit me, go ahead. Who is this? This is James Tallarico. He is a Presbyterian seminary graduate. He is also a candidate for Texas governor. Go. He goes to a lot of churches because part of his foundation is I'm a Christian. So he visits a lot of churches. See here, he's speaking at a church as a Christian candidate. Here he is, this next slide, speaking in his church. Go. Behind him, draped across the cross, is what? A gay pride flag. I think that's lost on a lot. Oh, you just hate gays. No, I'm just saying, would you look at this in the context of what we're looking at in Genesis 9? What is the signet that God promises grace for sexual sin? A rainbow. I believe the enemy has prompted some of the leadership in this whole movement. Hey, make a rainbow flag. The humans are probably missing it, but that's the enemy laughing and mocking God. Verse 14. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. Why did he have to? Because of perverse sexual sin. That was part of it anyway. Verse 16, the rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature and all flesh that is on the earth. Verse 17. And God said to Noah, this is a sign of the covenant, the rainbow. It's a sign of my grace, which I have established between me and all flesh on the earth. June 26th, 2015, President Obama wanted to celebrate the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark ruling of Obergefell versus Hodges. Well, what was that? That's when the U.S. Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage and made it mandatory for every state. All right. What did our president do at the time? Go. He did this. He festooned the White House in the colors of the rainbow. I don't think he knew what he was doing. There are gay people there that are celebrating. My purpose is not to bash this person or that person. I want you to see biblically harvest the times in which we are living. In Genesis 9, God said, I'm going to give you a promise of the rainbow. What did the devil do with that beautiful, beautiful symbol? He made it something very, very different. By the way, in 2015, if you're keeping track, anything happen? 9 African Americans were killed in a racist attack of Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. In December 2nd of that year, an ISIS-inspired couple, you might remember, killed 14 people in San Bernardino. 2015 marks roughly the prominent beginning of something called Black Lives Matter. And protest sparked across all the country. And how many cities, and our own city, Reno, were damaged by people rioting. Also, you might find this fascinating, in 2015, then President Barack Obama signed the nuclear deal with Iran. And have we seen the result of that? Verse 18, let's move quickly to the end. Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem. He's the beginning of the people called the Shemites or the Semites. That's going to be the people settling the Middle East. Ham, we'll see next week, he settled Africa. And Japheth, he settled Europe. All three, by the way, are present at the cross. Did you know that? The Shemites are there. That's Jesus and the Jews. The Hamites were there. That was Simon of Cyrene. And the Japhethites were there. That's the Romans. Continuing. And Ham was the father of Canaan, who was a real guy. But did he have a descendant of people? Yep. They were the Canaanites. Were the Canaanites a problem? They were the most defiled and perverse nation ever in your Bible. Well, how'd they get there? Verse 19. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. Verse 20. And Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard, and then he drank of the wine, and he was drunk. Uh-oh. Was he wino? Now remember, before the flood, he was a preacher of righteousness. Why did he get drunk? Some have speculated fermentation he was unaware of. Maybe that's why he was drunk. Could be. Or maybe after the great trial of the flood is over and the battle is won, is it in our sort of likeness to want to take it easy? I don't know. But here's what happened. He was drunk and he became uncovered in his tent. So he's just laying there naked. 22. Then Ham, who is the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told, really bragged, or exposed his father's sin to his two brothers. You wouldn't believe the state that dad is in. Verse 23. But Shem and Japheth, they took a garment. They laid it between their shoulders, and they walked in backwards so they wouldn't behold their father's uncovered state. They're covering dad's mistake. And they covered the nakedness of their father. Why does the Bible say so much about don't get drunk, don't get high, don't get buzzed? Why? Because here's the model. It exposes you. You become wide open for injury to yourself and others. How many of you have ever done things while you were drinking that you would have never done otherwise? Because you become exposed, vulnerable to foolishness, reckless harm to yourself and your family. Let's keep reading. Their faces were turned away. They didn't want to look upon their father's nakedness. And they did not see their father's nakedness. Good place to write Proverbs 10, verse 12. Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers a multitude of sin. Does that make sense? Yeah, that makes good sense. Okay, keep going. Yeah, I love Jesus, and I'm going to try to cover people's sin. I'm going to take that a little more closer to home. What about that person that's giving you a very rough time? Ex-spouse, terrible boss. What happens if you happen upon them? Busted in some terrible mistake. Now I got the goods. And I'm going to shred this guy. Well, that's a Ham type move. I got the goods. I can totally destroy that person. Or am I going to be like Shem and Japheth? Can I read Luke chapter 6, verse 36? Jesus, therefore be merciful. How? Just as your Father also is merciful. Don't label people, and you shall not be labeled yourself. Condemn not, and you will not be condemned. Forgive and you will be forgiven. Because what happens? Whatever a man sows, that's what he is going to reap. Give and it will be given back to you. For with the same measure that you use for others, God sees to it that it is measured back to you. It's a good process, by the way. Treat others as you would want to be treated, because God's watching. Verse 24. So Noah awoke from his wine, and he knew that his younger son had done to him. Then he said, "Cursed be Canaan." Wait a minute. I thought Ham was the one who messed up. Here he's cursing the son. What's going on? "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants he shall be to his brethren." What? Why curse Ham's son? I don't think this is Noah going to boogada and whipping out a shwammy on the kid. I don't think that's what's happening. I think that what happens is Noah is a pretty wise person. He knows what's going to happen. What do you mean? After all, do grandfathers as a rule grind on their grandkids? No. I think this is the wisdom of Noah. I think what he's saying is, "Hey, Ham, you have demonstrated a terrible lack of grace. Your love to expose, to belittle, to shame, plus your titillation for nakedness, it's going to get on your son." And you know what, Harvest? It did. The most sexually perverse culture in the Bible is going to turn out to be the Canaanites. It's one of the reasons why God says later to Joshua, "You got to destroy them. I cannot bear one more innocent child being born into that lifestyle. No more." And their love for the perverse, it destroyed them. Verse 26, "And he, Noah, said, 'Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant.'" And that's going to happen. Joshua does that in the book of Joshua. Verse 27, "And may God enlarge Japheth," that's the Europeans, "and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." Japheth, if you will, Europe, will eventually embrace Christianity, as you know. And there's some terrible examples of people wearing a Christian name badge who did awful things. But mostly, Europe sparks the Renaissance, the Industrial Revolution, hospitals, schools, universities, women's rights. Wherever true Christianity goes, so goes progress. And now verse 28, and that's what happened. "And Noah lived after the flood 350 years, so all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died."